Welcome to the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. I'm your host, David Yosefon, Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University School of Law in sunny Santa Clara, California. This is Episode 8 of the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. We're going to be discussing the new phenomena of public benefit corporations. These are to be contrasted with conventional or ordinary corporations. The bedrock governing law for ordinary corporations is that corporations are to be managed by their directors in such a way that pursues the best interest of the shareholders and not any other constituency. If you doubt that this is the law of corporate governance, please see my article, The Law of Corporate Purpose, in the Berkeley Business Law Journal, in which I make the case that this really is the prevailing law, whether or not you think it should be. I'm a critic of the shareholder primacy norm in corporate governance, but I have no doubt that the mainstream view is correct, that corporate law requires directors to manage the firm in a way that is beneficial or most beneficial to shareholders. Yes, when the firm can make profits by treating workers well or treating consumers well, being good to the environment because this attracts good workers and good consumers and gets government off their back, by all means, corporate directors are authorized to treat those other stakeholders well. But when there is a tension, and logic and experience suggest that tensions will emerge, where there is a tension between ordinary shareholder interest and the interest of other stakeholders, corporate law presently commands directors to operate the business in the interest of shareholders. New to the business world scene, however, is the emergence in the last decade or so of alternative forms of business organization that go by different kinds of names: social enterprise organizations, or the public benefit corporation, which is the term that Delaware uses. And if Delaware uses it, that's the term I'm going to use. The public benefit corporation, which provides a form of business organization that can be run in a way that makes profits for shareholders, so it's not a nonprofit organization, but which also requires the directors to balance the interests of shareholders against the interests of other constituencies. Other interests, which in Delaware would be specified in the public benefit corporation's chartering documents. We're going to be examining the promise or the limitations of these new organizational forms in today's episode with a scholar who is an expert in this emerging field. Please subscribe to us on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at David Yosefon. That's David, Y-O-S, like Sam, I-F, like Frank, O-N, like Nancy, at David Yosefon. I will tweet it anytime I'm posting a new episode in this podcast series. We are sponsored by the Markola Center for Applied Ethics here at Santa Clara University, and we're grateful for their sponsorship. Joining us now is Alicia Plerhopoulos from Georgetown Law Center. Alicia did her undergraduate work at Harvard. She has a master's degree from Princeton and a law degree from Yale Law School. So that's the East Coast trifecta, I think. After law school, Alicia worked at DLA Piper, and she's now the director of the Social Enterprise and Nonprofit Law Clinic at Georgetown. Alicia has published voluminously in a number of related areas, but especially in subjects bearing on our topic for today, and that is the new social enterprise or public benefit corporation model. Alicia, thank you so much for being a part of the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk with you today.
So what is a benefit corporation, and what, if any, good is it?
Well, you know, what is a benefit corporation? That really depends on the state that you're in. I've written a lot about public benefit corporations, which are particular to Delaware, but they're this entity, or this, I call them close cousins, I guess, with the benefit corporation, which is proliferated in a lot of states now. But, you know, generally, I would describe it either, you know, in any state you're in, it is the idea that there is the directors and owners of the of the corporation have their allegiances to multiple stakeholders. And this really means that they are trying to pursue or affect a positive change or a positive or have a positive effect, not just in terms of financially, returning financial return to their shareholders, but also trying to have some positive effect on society, possibly on their employees, possibly on the community that the corporation is existing in. In Delaware, with the public benefit corporation, you have to specifically state in your charter that you are pursuing some specific public benefit or producing some specific public benefit. So that's what the public, that's what the benefit corporation is generally, And so, to follow up with the second question, what good are they? That remains to be seen. Mm-hmm. I think that they are a new form where people really think they're innovative and trying to move business forward to be more socially responsible, really to act as a quasi-charity and do, quasi-charitable activities as well. So it remains to be seen, what these will become ultimately and how many organizations or how many corporations decide to become benefit corporations. But I think it's a step in the right direction in terms of corporate social responsibility and kind of quasi-charitable activities.
So to break down conceptually why we think these might be socially useful innovations that states are now offering, let me pose the question this way. Milton Friedman famously said that the social responsibility of corporations was to pursue profits for its shareholders. Mm-hmm. And Friedman, mm-hmm. of course, wasn't against charitable or philanthropic activity. He favored it, but he thought that the best way to pursue it would be to have corporations pursue profits for their shareholders, pay off dividends to their shareholders, and then if the shareholders so desired, they could contribute to charitable or philanthropic activity. Why is it more desirable to have both functions, the profit-making and the charitable activity, take place under the same roof in the same business?
Right. Yeah, I think that, quite honestly, Milton Friedman lived in a different time and a different era of a corporate activity. We have corporations now, the amount of, goods and services provided by corporations and where we, get our goods and services. They're very large companies, large conglomerates, really, that are providing, at least here in the United States, providing us with the people with the majority of their goods and services. And we touch corporations at every intersection of our lives. And therefore, when they are we are interacting so deeply with these corporations and they are ubiquitous. The idea is that, they need to actually have some responsibility as well. And so if they own large swaths of land and are producing all of these goods and all these services on these large swaths of land, then they need to treat that land, touch the land lightly, basically, and make sure that they are providing for future generations and not consuming, just for shareholders, future generations will be hurt by or harmed by. And so I guess I just, that's a little bit of an abstract notion, but really, the idea, there's also a loss of efficiency in that, the idea that, a corporation should just go out and pursue shareholder wealth, irregardless of other factors in society, other stakeholders in society, and then the profits can be given to charity. Well, there's an inefficiency there, right? Why? And again, I'll have the example of a forest, right? So if you have a company that's engaging in mass forest deforestation of an area, then, in order to have all these to maximize profits for shareholders, and then the shareholders can just donate, all of the profits to a charity that reforests the area. I mean, there's just a loss of efficiency there, mm-hmm. And it doesn't make sense. So I would say that, you know, having a form that that encourages kind of this type of social responsibility, you know, is a good thing.
So it seems to me that that is a plausible justification from the shareholder perspective, that there might sometimes be an efficiency to housing both the profit-making operations and the charitable giving function under the same roof. And this is really just a variation on Coase's theory of the firm.
I've heard people use the example of Starbucks, say, may have deep relationships with farmers in South America and literally have literal road networks that take them deep into very rural areas in South America that makes Starbucks well-positioned to be able to provide aid to extremely impoverished communities that surround the farmers that they're dealing with, and that it would be inefficient to simply engage in profit-making activity only to have some other enterprise reinvent all of those networks to then get into those communities to provide for the local indigents. But that's still really focusing only on the shareholder perspective, and so
right.
It seems that the when we're calling these enterprises, so far as I understand them, is really serving the shareholders' desire. Still focused on the shareholders' desire. If the shareholder wants profits, invest in a conventional corporation. If the shareholder wants profits with a conscience or profits with some charitable activity on the side, then the shareholder chooses the benefit corporation. But what do you think of the utility of these instruments as compared to others that might be available from the perspective of the non-shareholding stakeholder?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that you know, certainly the benefit corporation form is not for everyone. And I think that there are lots of other wonderful forms out there. Cooperatives, workers' cooperatives or consumer cooperatives certainly are useful. And I think have a lot of potential, I think, for empowering workers and getting capital into the hands of workers and wealth into the hands of workers rather than just shareholders. But I think, you know, my perspective, you know, at this time is kind of a let a thousand flowers bloom, mm-hmm. and that there's not going to be one size fits all mm-hmm. approach to entities. And I work a lot with, through my clinic at Georgetown, I work a lot with founders that are just starting out and they have this business idea or they've, you know, begun some simple operations, and they do have to make that choice of what do I want this business to be. And we have, you know, founders, and I advise them with my students on all of, you know, or an array of choices, not just corporations, but as you alluded to before, is, you know, workers' cooperatives as well. And other forms, and other entity forms. Mm-hmm. So I certainly don't think that the benefit corporation, you know, is the only, or you can accomplish what a benefit corporation aims to accomplish with a different form, certainly. Mm-hmm. You could certainly just accomplish what a benefit corporation aims to accomplish in a regular C corporation or just a traditional corporation. Mm-hmm. So in a little way, it is also at a branding effect, just mm-hmm. as if you know, a cooperative as well has a bit of a branding effect too.
So I think I can be persuaded that that this is one of numerous flowers that are, and while it's here, it stands to contribute to a socially desirable array of business institutions, but I remain a skeptic on a couple of domains. So let me ask you about those. Well, first off, is there a concern in the nonprofit community that rather than moving for-profit corporations in a somewhat socially desirable orientation, that the effect of these public benefit instruments will be to take traditional nonprofits and move them more towards the profit, towards a profit. As in other words, institutions that organized as conventional nonprofits will now see, well, we have this form which allows us to pursue nonprofit activity while also returning some profits to shareholders. So let's do that instead.
Yes, that is a very valid concern on the part of the nonprofit sector, nonprofit community. In fact, I've just started, I've just completed an article, a short article on this idea as the Delaware Public Benefit Corporation. Is it a nonprofit alternative? And will we see more, will we see more competition for capital, whether it's investment capital or donative capital, on the nonprofit front, because lots of organizations could now, instead of choosing to become, you know, a tax-exempt 501c3, they'll choose to become a benefit corporation. And I think that so it's certainly a valid concern, especially as giving to nonprofits was reduced during the Great Recession, and nonprofits, there has been this movement to kind of commercialize, or at least try to find sustainable or ways to sustain the charitable activities of a nonprofit. And one way is to, you know, obviously commercialize and do some commercial activities. And so I do think that this is a valid concern and a worry. So my prior paper, just looking at the public benefit corporations that had formed in Delaware in the first 3 months, found that, you know, 40% of those that did incorporate in those first 3 months, you know, could have alternatively, based on, you know, what they said their specific public benefit was, could have alternatively sought tax exemption and become a nonprofit corporation. So I do see that, you know, this is certainly competition in the same space. And again, we have to think, you know, critically, I think, about what the effect is going to be. At the same time, I think that the nonprofit sector has already been moving toward, as I said before, finding ways to make their charitable activities sustainable. And also moving beyond kind of this idea of just donations to one-off giving or donations to impoverished populations, or instead, I think there's been much more emphasis now on how can we really make an impact, a lasting impact that is allowing people that are the recipients of charity to really, to not just rely on donations, but to kind of have some type of sustainable or, improvement in their lives that's going to make their lives better in a way that they don't have to rely on donations or the charitable activities of these organizations anymore. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the idea, I think, right now, again, in the nonprofit sector is really about impact. And that is seen as kind of making a large impact, not just through donations, but making things sustainable. So,
So presently, these benefit corporations, they're taxed as if they were ordinary corporations. Is that right? They don't enjoy the tax exempt status of nonprofits.
They don't. Right. They don't have any taxable. They don't get any tax benefits.
Right. So I guess if you're a nonprofit, you're the question that you're facing is it more desirable to not reserve the right to pay profits and enjoy the tax benefits of the nonprofit status versus giving up the nonprofit status and having access to capital that you wouldn't otherwise get because you can promise to pay out at least some profits?
Exactly. But yes, and that's one of the calculations. But the other calculation is that, you know, the IRS regulations for nonprofits are, you know, they're onerous. So if you start a for-profit corporation, you're pretty much free to do, you know, what you you want. With a nonprofit, there, you know, there are regulations on how much commercial activity you can engage in. You know, if you are trying to be fully sustainable, and by financially sustainable, I mean, as a nonprofit, then the IRS actually questions why you need the tax benefit if you're fully financially sustainable. So as a part of being a 501c3, for example, you have to show at a minimum that 10% of your income is produced through public support, through donations, right? And that your operations aren't fully sustainable, financially sustainable. And so that, you know, for a social entrepreneur who really, again, wants to be financially sustainable, sees that and says, well, I don't want to go out there and fundraise. I'd like to, you know, go out and raise capital instead. There's other things, I think, too, that make just the tax exemption from the IRS onerous. And in that way, might encourage social entrepreneurs to choose a different form, particularly if, as a benefit corporation, you can get some of the same branding effect as a 501c3. So I have some clients who come in to me and say, you know, I really want to be a nonprofit because everybody knows nonprofits are good, you know, and everybody, as soon as you get that status, people understand that you're working on behalf of the greater good, or you're trying to achieve some charitable purpose. So they want that branding, right? And I think the benefit corporation, in some ways, to the extent that it gets more popular and more well known, can also give that a similar, not the same, but a similar branding effect.
So if you're a public benefit corporation, you might be operating in a way that's oriented towards serving the public good, but certainly there's no guarantee. If you'll bear with me for the benefit of our listeners, I want to read just a portion of the Delaware Benefit Corporation statute to pursue this line of questioning with you. So a dramatic statutory reading, if you will. Section 365 describes the duties of directors of a public benefit corporation in Delaware. And it says the board of directors, subsection A, says the board of directors shall manage or direct the business and affairs of the public benefit corporation in a manner that balances the pecuniary interests of the stockholders, the best interests of those materially affected by the corporation's conduct, and the specific public benefit or benefits identified in its certificate of incorporation. So far, so good. There's 365A. But then we get to 365B, and it doesn't say but I think a clearer drafting would have started off subsection B with saying but. B says, a director of a public benefit corporation shall not, by virtue of the public benefit provisions of subsection A of this title, have any duty to any person on account of any interest of such person in the public benefit or public benefits identified in the certificate of incorporation, or on account of any interest materially affected by the corporation's conduct. So therefore, the statute itself is very clear that no duty as to any of the non-shareholders that are described in the statute is created, and certainly no cause of action is available to any non-shareholding stakeholder to pursue any of the interests that are purportedly specified in their favor in the charter. So it might be the case that these benefit corporations are serving the public interest, but there's certainly no duty to do so that's established, at least not a duty that runs to those non-shareholders. So I guess what I want to ask is, from a general corporate social responsibility perspective, what my interest and concern has been that profit-oriented corporations generally, when they are assigned the right to pursue profits for shareholders, have an incentive to do so in a way that overreaches with respect to non-shareholding stakeholders, be they consumers, workers, or the environment. I had not thought that the principal problem of corporate irresponsibility in our society was the unavailability of a legal instrument through which shareholders did desire to invest in publicly beneficial ways could do so. I had rather thought that the principal problem was that capital was relatively unconcerned about the social consequences of its investment activity. And therefore, I'm not certain that the public benefit corporation is a very robust problem, a robust mm-hmm. answer to the general problem of corporate irresponsibility in our society. Now, I appreciate that it may have some marginal benefit for those shareholders who didn't have a sufficiently efficient instrument to pursue a balance that they might want. But with respect to whether this is one flower blooming, my worry is that what we have through the public benefit corporation is the creation of a kind of mirage of social responsibility, mm-hmm. or the appearance that Delaware has, if you thought corporations were a problem in our society, don't worry, Delaware's responded. They created the public benefit corporation. And to the mm-hmm. extent that we might make claims on Washington, there is this rhetorical now availability of, well, we've got a proliferation of lots of public benefit corporations, so that problem is being solved. So do you worry about the mirage effect with respect to masking the broader problem of socially irresponsible mm-hmm. corporate activity?
I worry about it, certainly. And I think that it's not just a worry, but it's an actuality. I do know, of one large for-profit company, an educational institution that recently converted to the Delaware Public Benefit Corporation. And prior to that conversion, it had been the target of, a U.S. Senate inquiry about defrauding students because they were providing educational services, but not to the standard or quality that they should have been, and really just getting federal grants and federal money. So that worries me. It certainly does worry me when an organization that had a really terrible reputation can then convert to a public benefit corporation and say, no, but we're doing, we're going to clean up our act and try to do really well, and whether that's going to happen or not is a question, mm-hmm. And whether this is just kind of greenwashing mm-hmm. is a serious issue. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think, actually, that it's not necessarily the corporate form that is helpful. If I were ever investing in a public benefit corporation, the thing that I would need to look at as an investor and as a socially responsible investor and impact investor is really their accounting mechanisms, their social accounting mechanisms that actually tell you that impact mm-hmm. that they're making. And without that, you really can't know. You can't know, just as if just because an organization is a 501c3, you can't know that they're doing good work. You have to look at their Form 990, which is their annual tax return that shows what work they're doing, and think about kind of how much money they're spending on overhead versus how much money they're spending on their actual activities. And so, in the same way, I think that you have to, for any public benefit corporation, you'd have to look at their accounting, social accounting mechanisms. Now, I think that field, social accounting, is growing and maturing at this point. There's organizations, obviously, that do social accounting or impact reporting. And I think that real progress certainly is being made in those fields and in that field, and should be continued to be made, so that we can really actually assess how these organizations are behaving.
Right.
And again, you can do that you can look at the social impact of a regular C corp mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, so that's another question that is raised, is what impact will the emergence of these benefit corporations have on the charitable activity of conventional corporations? Mm-hmm. Conventional for-profit corporations are involved. Many of them today are involved in enterprises that are purportedly in the social interest, in the public interest. Of course, when push comes to shove, directors or officers of these firms will always, at the last moment, specify or assert that these activities are actually in the shareholder interest, because it ends up making the firm mm-hmm. look good in the eyes of the workers or consumers or Congress. But is there some concern that the charitable activities of conventional corporations will be decreased as firms say, perhaps genuinely or sincerely, that, well, we know our shareholders are not particularly concerned about investing in a socially conscious way. If they were, they would have invested in the benefit corporation. Clearly, they've invested in us mm-hmm. for that kind of mm-hmm. Friedman-esque profit. You know, maybe they're perfectly charitable individuals in their private lives, but they want their corporation to pursue profits. I know right. that theorists have raised that concern. Do you think it's a practical mm-hmm. concern?
I don't think it's a practical concern. That one I don't think is one. You know, these corporations do charitable activities not only because they want to do, it makes their business look better and look more caring, but they also get charitable, you know, tax deductions for doing so. It does really affect the branding of the business itself. So I don't see, you know, people picking and choosing and saying, well, I want to do really good, I'm going to be a tax-exempt organization. Or I kind of want to do good, but I want to make profits, so I'm going to be a benefit corporation. Well, I want to do evil, so I'm going to be a C corporation. That's just not going to, you know, that's not how it's going to play out. And I don't think that, you know, when these new forms were chosen or adopted by legislatures across the country, that there was an idea that, okay, only, you know, traditional corporations are all bad because we have this, you know, third way in between. Certainly not that. I don't think anybody in any of the legislatures would say that. So I think that they, you know, corporations will continue their charitable activity. You know, they will likely continue it through, especially the large ones. They have their own foundation. You know, they'll continue that activity. You know, what I was going to say was on the nonprofit side, what you might see happening more is actually a nonprofit tax-exempt, you know, parent having a for-profit benefit corporation subsidiary, so that the nonprofit can do the charitable activity and the for-profit can do the commercial activities without jeopardizing the tax exemption of the parent. And so you might see those types of structures popping up. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I've definitely counseled clients on structuring their activities that way in order to get the best of both worlds.
So can you tell us, I read with great interest your Who's Opting In article, Delaware Public Benefit Corporations 90 Days Out, Who's Opting In? And you actually did there's a lot of armchair theorizing, I think, about public benefit corporations, but you actually got in there. And so I was recently working on a draft of my own in which I was asserting that for-profit corporations are hardly falling over themselves, rushing to the public forum, that they're mm-hmm. that they're crawling, and that this my view claim is that the failure of for-profit corporations to reorganize as benefit corporations gives the lie to the corporate claim that all stakeholder interests are already aligned in corporate enterprise, and that there's profits to be had in treating consumers and the environment and workers well, so we need not be especially concerned about corporate overreach with respect to these communities. But leave that argument aside. Mm-hmm. What did you find in your empirical mm-hmm. investigation in Delaware with respect to who's actually choosing this form so far?
Yeah, so as you said, nobody, you know, this isn't a mad rush to convert into or start a public benefit corporation. You know, thousands of corporations are formed in Delaware every year, and you know, by my research, in the first 90 days, only 55 public benefit corporations were formed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what I found in just looking at the charters of these organizations or their, and really just doing some research to the extent that they had websites or operations up and running that I could do research on, I looked at that as well. And so these 55 companies, you know, they, for the most part, 70% of them are new organizations. And by new, that really meaning that this is their first incorporation. They weren't converting from a different form, that they were just starting out their operations. So really young, you know, very young companies, obviously. There was a range of kind of activities, too, that they were doing. You know, I grouped them according to different industries, but about 30% of them were in some type of professional services industry, mm-hmm. in terms of consulting or legal services or financial services. The technology and education sectors each represented about 11%. 10% were engaged in some type of consumer retail product, and 9% were engaged in healthcare, the healthcare sector. And then, you know, as I said before, about 40% of them, based on kind of what they said their specific public purpose was, about 40% of them probably could have incorporated as a 501c3 or a tax-exempt organization. And these were you know, some of them were full universities, you know, that had or were just starting out, right. And or other educational services.
I was wondering whether you thought that was bad lawyering, or was there maybe was there an intention behind that they could have chosen the? I guess it goes back to our earlier conversation. Mm-hmm. It may speak to their assessment of how it's going to be easier for them to attract investment. But maybe mm-hmm. it was just bad lawyering. Mm-hmm. What's your view on that?
Yeah, I mean, it potentially could have been bad lawyering, although I don't know. I think that there is probably this cost-benefit analysis that the founders do, hopefully in conjunction with their lawyer and their tax advisors, that they, you know, that there probably is this cost-benefit analysis that they do. Is, you know, how do we want to run our organization? You know, are we going to be out there fundraising, you know, and getting soliciting donations, and do we think people will donate to these causes? Or are we going to, you know, or is this something? Is this organization have something that we can sell? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. and that could actually sell. At a price that's going to sustain itself. Mm-hmm. So I think that really, you know, in essence is probably, you know, the calculation that people do. And I think that if you have a product or a service that you can sell and not rely on donations, then it's pretty clear, you know, that you don't need to be or shouldn't be a 501c3 tax-exempt organization.
Right.
And so I think... For an example, I think one of the organizations I found was this educational curriculum that was geared toward Latino youth, and so of course, you know, it potentially could be a tax exempt organization, but yet if you can actually sell that curriculum, maybe not directly to the youth, but to schools, for example, mm-hmm. or to universities, then. You know, you can, you know, form as a for-profit, not as a non-profit. So that's what I think. You know, I hope it wasn't bad lawyering, but
right.
I think that's the type of analysis.
Well, maybe we'll have to check back in 180 days or 365 days. There were a couple. I was surprised to see that there were a few very large, in terms of capitalization, very large corporations that have chosen the public benefit form. Was that surprising to you? And are any of these corporations publicly traded?
Right. So no one yet is no individual. Public benefit corporation is publicly traded yet. There are wholly owned either affiliate or subsidiary of a large publicly traded for-profit company that is that wholly owns a public benefit corporation. But you know, the major ones, you know, that I think people tend to think of, or maybe they don't, maybe I just do because I study this stuff, but are, you know, Method Soap, which is the, or Method, and it has the line of environmental responsible household cleaning products and soaps.
Yes. We use Method in us. I didn't even know that was a public benefit.
Yes, it is. It's a public benefit corporation, and
I've been getting a form of consumption in my hand washing that I didn't even appreciate I was getting.
Exactly. Sold in Target. You know, I think it's become very popular.
I have greater utility than I even knew in my life.
There's also Plum Organics, or actually it used to be called Plum Organics, and now it's just Plum. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, if I have two children, and so they used to eat a lot of Plum, which is a baby food.
We feed that to our children as well. It looks like we're fully invested as consumers in public
in public benefit corporations. Yeah, I think you know, there are the other, I guess, big one is not a Delaware corporation, but it's a California benefit corporation, and that's Patagonia, which is the clothing maker, outdoor clothing,
right,
and gear. Well, so there, you know, there are these. There are some, again, I think Plum is the one that was just acquired. That's right. So Plum was acquired, I believe, in last summer by Campbell Soup, and so it is a wholly owned subsidiary of Campbell Soup.
Okay.
And Method actually, I think, merged last year with a international company, or I think maybe a German company that does similar products as well. So there are large, you know, very again, well-known large corporations that are public benefit corporations.
Yeah, it's now this is conceptually challenging to have a public benefit corporation that has that specifies it's going to balance its public attention with profit making, being fully owned by a corporation whose charter says we're going to pursue profits for shareholders. I wonder if there's at least some superficial tension in that kind of ownership structure. Perhaps that's a subject for a follow-up podcast, and I hope that you will agree to be a guest with us again. I want to give you the opportunity as we're closing here. I'm hoping that there might be some policymakers listening to this podcast now or down the road. If you had one reform to instruments that you would like to see developed, a technical one or a broad one, what kind of a legal problem or tweak to the instrument would you like to see?
To the public benefit corporation itself, I guess I would like to see a little bit more teeth in terms of enforcement, and some enforcement mechanism that actually makes directors accountable for the public benefits that they that they claim to be pursuing. And I know there's been a lot of talk about, you know, what that might be or how that might be pursued. But the, you know, there is some need to ensure that you know, that this isn't going to just be greenwashing or a big PR stunt, you know. So I think some enforcement mechanism, and there's been ideas floated around how that might happen, but that's what I'd like to see.
Perhaps your clinic will be working on that, and we'll look forward to re-engaging on the subject. Alicia Plerhopoulos, you've given us a great introduction to the public benefit corporation landscape, and we're very grateful for your time.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. All right, that's it. That's our episode for today. I'm very grateful to Professor Plerhopoulos for her insight and her learning on this subject. We will revisit with her and with other scholars who are working on the public benefit corporation. It certainly introduces numerous theoretical
puzzles as well as policy conundrums. As usual, I find my own mind twisted into a deeper knot by our conversation, which tells me that I understand public benefit corporations a little better than I thought I did before we started. I don't know quite what I think, but that tells me I understand it a little bit better than I did when I thought I knew what I think. I hope you're a little confused too. I hope you'll stay with that confusion. And if you think you begin to understand, well, then I hope you'll check in with the next episode of the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast, and we'll see what we can't do to tangle you up a little bit. It's one of the great humorous mysteries of the human experience. The only time that I know what I'm talking about is when I know I'm confused. It's when I think that I know what I'm talking about that I know I must have it wrong. Now, that's not to say you have to do what you have to do when you're executing, when you're making decisions in your business life, in your intellectual life, in your personal life. You've got to work with whatever provisional truths or provisional understandings you've come to. Recognize them, though, as provisional, as not fully worked out, and as waiting, always waiting, on the next episode of this podcast. Thank you for taking the time. I look forward to our next session together. Cue up your outgoing music in your mind. I'll talk to you next time.